The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
So, what's been on my mind lately is the topic of ethics, Buddhist ethics. Traditionally, ethics is considered a very important part of Buddhist practice, so much so as it's called the foundation for it. Though perhaps in Buddhism and classically in India, you wouldn't use the word ethics, of course. It's an English word with a lot of associations here in the West. Some of them good, some of them not so good. But ethics has to do with how we behave, what we do. And there are perhaps two very large questions that religions sometimes address. One of them is, who are we? And the other is, what do we do? What are the important things to do in this life of ours? And you have trouble hearing? Is it working? Is everybody, people here okay? You can't hear out there. Well, Abraham. So the question of what we do, how we live our lives, has a lot to do with ethics, or ethics has a lot to do with how we live our lives. And what's the source of ethics? What's the source of guidance for how we live our lives? How do we decide between all the different choices we could make? And then it gets more complicated, the issue of ethics, it isn't just a matter of what we do as an individual, but how does our actions interface with that of others? How does our actions interface with that of our society? And so once you get into that, it gets more complicated. And then quickly it gets political. How do we live in such a way that we live, you know, ethically? And part of why it was been on my mind is I read this weekend a quote from I think it was a TV interview with President Obama. I guess he was asked about the Occupy Wall Street movement about 3 weeks after it started. And he expressed some understanding and maybe some sympathy for that movement. And he said that it's kind of understandable that in the biggest financial crisis since the Great Depression that's had, he called it a huge collateral damage, that people would like to see some repercussions for the people who were responsible for that crisis. And see, that's understandable, that should be. And then he was asked, well, why aren't some of these hedge fund managers, why aren't the Lehman Brothers executives, why aren't they taken to court? Why aren't they prosecuted? And then this is what he said, I thought was really interesting. He said, well, it turned out they didn't do anything illegal. But what they did was immoral. Immoral and reckless. So that's what the president said. Now, you know, he's a politician, and so how do we hold that? But I thought that was quite a statement to make, that, you know, there's some huge sector, certain individuals in a sector of our society have clearly been immoral. And so it caused me to look up in the dictionary what morality means, because I don't know. Do you guys know what it means? Because, you know, Buddhists, English-speaking Buddhists that I know, very seldomly use the word moral and immoral. It's not kind of part of Buddhist English. And so I thought, I should look up in the dictionary, what is this moral, morality, immorality, immoral mean? And the dictionary definition that I read was that morality has to do with right and wrong. And so it has to do with behavior and deciding what kind of behavior that based on what's right and wrong. And, you know, it's pretty abstract, the ideas of right and wrong. But generally, what I've seen in Buddhism doesn't evaluate things from right and wrong. We might say things are right and wrong, in a sense, but that's not really the reference point in Buddhism. The reference point in Buddhism is for behavior or something else. So the idea of behavior and ethics, I think, is close to the heart of everybody. I think it has, you know, a central issue to what it means to be a human being, is to have some basis upon which to look at our actions and what we do and how we relate to society. And then we had the report that was in the news today that, not so new, but it was today, it certainly impacted me reading it, where it said that 16% of people in the United States live in poverty. That's 49 million people, said. And there was some quibbling about whether it's 16% or 15.3% or something. But that's pretty impressive. And they define poverty as a family of four that lives with less than $24,000 a year. That's phenomenal, 16% of the country. And so, you know, how do we live? How do we as individuals live in as members of society where that's, you know, what's going on in the society? Are we just simply not responsible? You know, it's not my problem. You know, I have a job and I have, you know, a house and, you know, they should get a job, or, you know, so the government should think about it, or the hedge fund managers should think about it, or someone should think about it, but not, you know, not my problem. Or is it our problem? So part of also, there are all these little threads that went into my mind for this, think my thoughts today, and one of them was Marna, who's sitting here. I hope it's okay to point out her. So Marna, probably those of you see her here, she, you know, she doesn't strike you as being, you know, particularly young. She's older than me, I think. She doesn't look like this wild, hairy person who lives in tents on plazas in Oakland and, you know, running around with... And, you know, she's a very dignified, probably a grandmother, aren't you? Dignified grandmother. And I happened to walk by one of the Occupy demonstrations a few weeks ago, and there was Marna with a sign. It said something like, what did it say, your sign say?
I think it said, we have enough resources for everything we need.
So we have enough resources for everything we need. We have enough resources for everyone if we shared it. And this has been a common theme that I've been hearing for decades, that some people will speak up and say, we have enough resources to share everybody, share if we all shared. And so rather than Occupy Wall Street, it should be apple pie for everyone. That everyone should, you know, should be shared. And so that was kind of struck me. You know, here was, you know, one of our members of IMC, and here we have this big thing going on with the Occupy movement. We also have a big thing going on with the Tea Party. Both of them are really new phenomena. One is like, what, 2 years old, and Occupy is less than 2 months old. It's already making a big impression. And then it points to this, you know, to talk about the Tea Party and the Occupy Wall Street movement, you talk about a huge divide in our country. And so what do we do with this huge divide? And, you know, is it possible to explain rationally what is right and wrong? Explain, you know, what should happen and what shouldn't happen. There was a study I read recently of, they did a survey of the central core values of liberals and conservatives. And they both, you know, have beautiful values that they kind of organize themselves around, but it just happens to be different values. So in survey, they tend to find that liberals, their values are at the highest, score highest in their list of valuable values, is fairness and caring. Whereas for conservatives, apparently, the highest, what has highest value, are the values of loyalty, respect, and purity. So then the researchers who found this out were kind of then theorizing why this might be, the difference. And the theory was that it has to do with location, the communities in which they lived, and that somehow the nature of different communities tends to produce different kinds of ethics, different kind of values that people want to live by. And the theory was that is that these kind of values of loyalty, respect, and purity tend to arise in communities that are close-knit and heterogeneous. And that communities that are much more, close-knit and homogeneous, whereas the values of caring and fairness tend to arise in communities that are more heterogeneous, more mixed and diverse. And so they pointed out that's a little bit like, you know, the East Coast, West Coast, especially the big port cities tend to be where tend to be quite much more liberal. Places where a lot of immigrants are came tend to be more liberal, whereas places where much more homogeneously, usually homogeneously white, tend to have other values. And you see that across the world, that cultures that have very close-knit community values have certain kind of, you know, have whole sets of values come with that. Some of them that some of us can't understand here from the West. So how do we speak, you know? How do we use these values as a reference point for how we act in the world? And then do we go out and act in the world angrily demanding or angrily upset that, you know, that should be different? Or how do we create change for our society? Should we be agents of change, or should we be agents of not be agents of change? Should we just sit quietly and meditate in the privacy of our homes in an IMC and, you know, not worry about anything else? Or should we be out there on the streets one way or the other, throwing tea overboard or raising tents? What should it be? And then the question, you know, here we're at a Buddhist center, so what's the role of Buddhism? What does Buddhism have to teach us? What values, what direction does Buddhism give? And I think that has to be a little bit topic of my talk, otherwise I don't think I have any business talking about any of this. And so what does Buddhism have to offer? My first Buddhist teacher has said something that made a big impression on me. He said, the Buddha taught the value of sitting. Gandhi taught that it was important to choose where you sat. Because if you sit in the privacy of your own home, that's very different than if you sit on the plaza in Oakland. And I was kind of delighted to see last week there were a photograph in the newspaper of Buddhists at the Occupy, you know, Oakland protest, and they were sitting meditating. Very different than the image of the protesters who were breaking doors and spraying graffiti and things. And I like that. I like, you know, that's a nice way of speaking up by sitting down publicly. And then I was thinking about, you know, Gandhi is a big reference point for me. And when I read also that there are these merchants in Oakland and New York City who are around the plazas where the Occupy movements are, who are now struggling financially because there's no business, I thought about Gandhi, and I thought, no, Gandhi would never have done that. Gandhi would have been very careful not to have caused any harm to anybody. And I'm very happy to say that I'm pretty confident that Marna's demonstration did not cause any harm. to any of the local merchants at all. And the fact that Gandhi would think, Gandhi would, you know, had this big thing he was trying to do, but his concern was always how to do it in a way that it wasn't going to cause any harm. How do we do it so that our anger or upset doesn't harm anybody or doesn't get the upper hand? How do we consider what doesn't harm? And this, I think, is what, if we get back to Buddhism, what Buddhist ethics is based on. Buddhist ethics is not based on, you know, abstract principles and right and wrong, but rather it tends to be based on what causes harm and what brings the alleviation of harm. What brings harm and what brings benefit to people? What brings suffering and what's the alleviation of suffering? What brings happiness? So maybe those are also a little bit abstract, but suffering is not too abstract if you're suffering. Happiness maybe is a little bit harder to define. Benefit is a little bit harder to define. But it's a little bit, you know, I think it's less abstract than right and wrong. And so the Buddhist analysis tends to be, you know, where's the benefit? Where's what's beneficial? What's helpful? And so Buddhist ethics is based on these notions of helpfulness, what's helpful and what's not helpful, what's beneficial and what's not beneficial. And that tends to be situational. You can look at each situation and see. And then, more interestingly, I think, is that when the Buddha talked about ethics, or let's say, when he talked about wisdom, he defined wisdom as, or a wise person, as someone who considered the benefit of oneself, the benefit of others, and the benefit of both self and others. A wise person avoids harming self, harming others, and harming both self and others. And I think this is a very interesting definition of wisdom. It's not so abstract. Sometimes people want to have wisdom as being something, you know, only if you have a PhD in Stanford, maybe are you wise. But, you know, knowing what's beneficial and what's not beneficial, you know, what's harmful and not harmful, that doesn't often take, you know, a PhD in philosophy. It just, you know, hopefully it's something we can evaluate ourselves. And then you come to meditation. What's in Asia, in Buddhist Asia, like in Southeast Asia, it's very common there for the Buddhist teachers there to insist that the entryway, the first step into Buddhism, Buddhist practice, is through ethics, through living an ethical life, living by the precepts, practicing loving kindness, practicing generosity, being ethical. And that's kind of required beginning. And I remember many years ago there was a woman from, I think, Taiwan, a Buddhist practitioner, who came to America, and she left a law career that she had here and went to study Buddhism. And she took a class I was teaching, and she was completely committed. She was going to make her life about Buddhism, studying Buddhism. And so I asked her if she had a Buddhist teacher, and she said, "Oh yeah, I have a Buddhist teacher." And I said, "Do you meditate?" And she said, "No, not yet. I'm preparing myself for that." And I was so inspired by that. That, you know, most people I know here in the West, these convert Buddhists, you know, they want to go for the meditation first. But she had so much respect for meditation and what it takes to meditate, she was preparing the ground for that with her behavior, her ethics, her studies, or whatever. I thought that was quite nice. So in Asia, the tendency has been that, you know, ethics, you start with ethics. In here in the West, for the last 50 years, as Westerners have gotten involved in Buddhism, most Westerners have gotten involved in meditation first. And so people say they have it upside down. It should be ethics first and then meditation. But I think the door for a lot of Westerners is meditation. It's partly because we want to see benefits right away, and partly because the idea of ethics is a little bit complicated, to say the least, and sometimes a little bit hesitant. You know, if I did a I do a popular 6-week introduction to meditation class here at IMC. And, you know, last year we've been getting 100 people come each time. But I'm pretty confident that if I offered a 5-week class on ethics, You know, there might be three or four people. It wouldn't be as popular, that's my guess. So meditation is kind of the door. It's practical, it's personal, it's immediate, the results more or less. But then the thing that usually happens is if a person meditates for quite a while, enough, it somehow changes their heart, it changes their sensibilities, it changes their sensitivity, their awareness, and that change also changes their ethics. And so what tends to happen is that people become interested in ethics and Buddhist ethics after meditating for a while. So it comes in the wake of meditation, rather than meditation coming at the after wake of ethics. And so then the interesting question is, how is it that meditation affects our ethics or our ethical behavior? How are we changed by it? And as you know, those of you who haven't been changed yet, do you want to be changed this way? And how does it change us for the better, so that we are inspired to live more ethically, both in, you know, locally, as for the one-on-one encounters we have with other people, but also in a kind of wider scale in our society? What is it about meditation that might make a person more ethical? What is it about meditation that might inspire a person to begin, not because they've been told to, rather than being told they should be ethical, what is it about meditation that encourages a person to be ethical? Rather than being told you should think about others and think about what's beneficial for them and avoiding harming them, what is it about meditation that prompts or encourages a person to begin seeing that way or considering things that way on their own? So what is it? So that's my question for you. So I'd like to hear what you think. So if you can use the mic.
I think for me it was to see the whole, like meaning I was able to see the effect of my action. Like on everything and everyone over time, and I was able to see kind of what yielded something positive for me and what yielded something negative. So I was able to see the ripples and mm-hmm.
So something about meditation helped you to see over time the whole picture and the consequences of how you lived. And before you meditated, you didn't see that?
I think before I meditated, a lot of stuff, a lot of things were happening, very automatic. And I think I was losing sight of it. So I wasn't just aware of these implications.
Beautiful. And any sense of what happened in meditation that gave you this more holistic vision?
I think any impurity that I had against anyone in any form, like it reflected in my body. Like I could feel my breath change, my body change in very subtle ways. So it was very, when I sat, it was, the volume was turned on a lot whenever this impurity happened, because I think we tend to recall those memories of impurities as they arise, because I don't think, like, if once you express anger or lust, like, it stays in the body for a long, long time.
So part of what meditation did for you, there was a heightened sensitivity to your body and the consequences there, and as you saw the consequences in yourself, you became then also more aware of the consequences outside of you and others.
Yes, yes. And being completely selfish, it was for me. You know, it was best for me not to do that. Because my body was undergoing a lot of stress. So
if you were going to be really selfish, really well.
Exactly.
Then you don't want to be selfish. So yes, thank you.
I think for me it was an opening of the heart in a way that caused me to feel more compassion for others and myself. And I think you couldn't not care more when you're in that space more of the time. You know, at least that's
so an opening of the heart, a heightened sensitivity in your heart, And so how could you not have more compassion or care if that, that sensitivity is there?
Right.
Okay, thank you.
Sure.
That's such an interesting question. it seems to me intuitively that it could be twofold. On the one hand, the respect and the self-care and the love that I was offering to myself by engaging in the practice helped me to transfer that love and respect, I think, to others.
Mm.
On the other hand, when I was in deep pain and suffering, and I could find some way of dealing with that suffering, I developed compassion for myself. And then if I see other beings that are suffering, then I can't help but want to offer them the same compassion.
Mm. Beautiful.
It only makes sense.
So your heightened sensitivity to your own suffering helped you feel compassion for others. And bringing developing this heightened sensitivity, bringing attention to yourself in a loving, respectful way, caring for yourself this way, then also translated to wanting to do the same for others. Beautiful. Thank you.
For me, doing meditation changes my behavior by having stuff not matter. I don't know that I become more compassionate or anything. I think maybe that's true, but or maybe that's there, but it's almost like it becomes obvious that everything that seems to have weight or importance just really isn't.
Mm.
And so it's more of a letting go.
Mm. So that's great. And many people have some experience like that. But as that happens, do you find that new things become more important than they had been before? Or everything lessens in importance?
No, not... Other... stuff comes in. I mean, I don't stay in that meditative mm-hmm. space. But it reminds me of what you were saying last week, or maybe some other time, that it's an openness. And so it's more just open.
Uh-huh. And then from that openness, when you walk out into the world with that openness, how does that affect your ethical evaluation, ethical choices? Are you more ethical? Are you less ethical? Are you indifferent?
It isn't so much indifferent. It's more just accepting.
Mm. And how is that beneficial ethically?
I don't know. That's just what happens.
Yeah, uh-huh. It's beautiful. Thank you. So here, Marna, now.
I guess I was thinking that when you meditate, when I meditate, I commit to just stop. And the stopping means stopping thinking and activity or whatever that is more mundane. I commit to sit and stop and pay attention. And as other people have said, what I'm paying attention to is what's in the heart, which is what I'm normally overlooking because I'm too busy with all this stuff. And so you sit and you suddenly pay attention to what your heart is feeling, and that heart is something that seems to have an ability on its own to just know the ethics, because if you're not acting in accord with what your heart is perceiving, but you're not paying attention to, you don't feel good in there. And so it's not that you really need to think, you just, at least for me, it seems like I just need to feel that something doesn't feel in alignment. And the point of sitting is to realize that you don't feel right about how you've been living or how you've been doing something, and then I think the ethics comes from that recognition that you need to get in alignment with what would be, I suppose, what is good for other people and yourself.
Beautiful. So the heart becomes the reference point for this.
Yes, I think for me it's about slowing down. It's about removing myself from the pace of the world and the inconsequential mood and pace of the of it's almost like a madness of the world that continues to drive forward. Where when I meditate, I can slow down and become more in the moment and feel the consequences of, or feel how I am acting at the moment, and feel that the consequences of my behavior can be more, I can be more at ease with it, or more felt, rather than being caught up in the whole pace of the world. I think what you were saying about President Obama, where he compared the ethics with the morality, and there was a sort of a disconnect there. When I meditate, I want to be disconnected from the rash consequences of our, of the world, and just be in tune with my own personal feelings of how I should act.
And then if you, and then there's a different kind of connection to the world then?
Exactly. I view the world through my own filter rather than the news and the outside world, but more through my own filter.
That's good. So meditation helps you slow down, so you're no longer living through the filters, the ideas, the concepts that are society is kind of pouring down on you, politicians and everyone. And then you become your own kind of teacher, your own guidance from something inside that you trust that's meaningful for you, heightened sensitivity. And
yes, I think that's what I'm saying.
Beautiful. Thank you.
Looking at my craving and aversion during meditation, going out into the real world, I see looking at those affects my ethics outside.
So by looking at your cravings in meditation, what do you learn there that affects what you do outside of meditation?
I'd say, according to, I guess, how it affects ethics, when I'm wanting something, I am more in tune with how it affects myself and other people at the same time.
Great. Thank you. Let me give it to her, Shinkwan, see what she says.
I guess I would resonate with a lot that's already been said. The slowing down allows me to see what's actually happening. Actually seeing what's happening and meeting the suffering allows the compassion to arise. And allowing the compassion to arise allows care, and I guess it affects my behaviors and actions.
Great. Thank you. And then I wonder about Bobby. Do you want to say something, Bobby? Is she listening? No. Oh, well. Bobby, do you want to say something?
Me?
Yeah. Wait for the mic.
One of the few elders in the group, huh? Now it's been a long. I've been around for a long time and through a lot of trouble, worn through. You know, when I think today, what you young people, if you're under 30, you're young. Or if you're under 50, you're young. But I think you even, in many ways, need more of this understanding. Because I think what Dick and I have come through and the kind of wars and disasters we've faced and the losses of people close to us and young people too, that's an awfully harsh way to have to look at life and say, what is it all about? So it did early get us to look at what is it? What is it that's really of value?
Beautiful, beautiful. And how's meditation helped you?
It's connected to prayer, or what I learned of prayer early on, and it is in some set religions that you can use it as meditation. That silence is a part of the religious.
Mm-hmm.
Gets mixed up a lot with music and singing and activity, but basically the churches I've found that have been responsive to the need of the people to have that security in at least one place, in one place where people are gathering willfully.
Mm-hmm. Beautiful. Thank you. As it also points out to this idea that I wonder to what degree, for Buddhist meditators, to what degree meditating together as a group also affects your ethics, and whether your ethics are different whether you meditate alone or whether you feel connected to a community. And so for many people, it's just, a spiritual community is very important. And how does that affect ethics and then how we behave out in the world? So someone else. Do we have... Maybe Abraham, can you move that? This one over there. Oh, there it goes. Thank you.
So far, a lot of this resonates with me, but I guess a couple things came up. One in which that... when I'm meditating and trying to be just with my breath and in my own moment, I notice a lot about where my mind wants to go, which is I cling a lot to things. And the clinging, I guess noticing that and knowing, I guess what I want to talk about is like intention. Like if I'm clinging to something, it's self-involved and it's usually intended to... For me, it's a desire or something that I want. And if I, in meditation, notice it and can do something about it and reach into my heart and really know what I should be doing to lessen my suffering and also others, because I don't treat people all that well all the time. If you notice that you're actually your intention's wrong, then you're going to actually... be more ethical and in the future act differently.
So meditation helps you do that.
Yeah.
So it sounds like meditation isn't always pleasant for you.
No. It's interesting to see where my mind goes,
But it's worthwhile.
It's worthwhile because in the long run, I take it out of meditation and I still see it for what it is and can do something about it instead of just living with it. Because it doesn't cause... joy all the time.
That's wonderful. So. Thank you very much. Mm-hmm. I appreciate that. Maybe one or two more before we end the evening. Over here. Okay, there. Maybe where's the other mic now? Maybe you pass that over to the corner there and to the lady there by the window, and then Joel.
So what I felt... It's funny. I went to this group on Sundays for a while. I was kind of down in Santa Cruz a lot, and it's just kind of gospel new age group. It's an incredible group. And one of the songs they'd sing just a lot would be, "Nobody Can Take My Joy Away From Me." And they'd sing it, and it was just an amazing, just sometimes hundreds of people together, and it was a real popular song there. And what I've gotten from meditation, especially, I guess, the last few years, because I've been a little bit more disciplined about it, is that I have this kind of an inner joy that's just kind of this hum and aliveness that's there. And when I get these negative thoughts, which I sense that if I kind of move those too much or that becomes too powerful, it would probably affect my behavior out there. It's that joy that kind of keeps it at bay. It's almost like this power that's just kind of, oh, those thoughts just lessen. They don't have the momentum. And those thoughts will probably just ease up what I'm kind of doing or how I'm being in the world.
Beautiful. So wonderful. So you have this capacity of having bad thoughts, negative thoughts, and you have
occasionally.
But that somehow the meditation, the joy that you feel in meditation, keeps those from getting the upper hand for you.
Yes.
And so your behavior is better because of that.
Uh-huh.
Wonderful. Thank you. So last one here.
I recently watched the movie Good Will Hunting. For those in the audience who haven't seen that movie, it's with Matt Damon and Robin Williams and a Liam Neeson lookalike character. I'm not quite sure what his name is. But there's a scene in the movie where Robin Williams and the Liam-like character are sitting in a bar, and they're discussing the care of their patient, who is Matt Damon. And Robin Williams sort of plays this scruffy, unsung hero type of character. The Liam Neeson-like character plays this sort of egotistical, world-famous mathematician. And at one point, Robin Williams assumes that Liam Neeson, lookalike, is really out for himself in trying to help the Matt Damon character. And the Liam Neeson character is really upset by this, and he uses this example of, which is this, that there was this this Indian boy who lived in a very rural village in India. And at some point he had gotten his hands on a very simple mathematics book. And from that text, which might not have gone beyond arithmetic, he was able to extrapolate Pythagorean theorem and, you know, all sorts of mathematics without necessarily being taught those mathematics directly. And I was really struck by that because I thought, well, how the heck is that possible? And your conversation tonight reconnected me with that and made me think, well, maybe that was all coming from his heart. And so I personally am not mathematically inclined, and I probably don't have skills beyond arithmetic, but my intention in meditation is to connect with the depths of what is in my heart. And I know that my intention is to connect with other people regardless of who they are or where they come from. And so even though I'm in my own little world with this analogy with just my little mathematics textbook, I hope that by studying that, my heart can open to the point where maybe I can understand so much more beyond what's in front of me.
Oh, yeah.
And maybe that ultimately allows me to connect with all sorts of people in this gigantic world.
Beautiful. It's wonderful. Mm-hmm. The there are various geniuses in the world, and I tend to believe that if we meditate, we become ethical geniuses. We all have the capacity for that. And my hope is that Buddhist people who practice Buddhism, there is no Buddhism, but the people who practice Buddhism, that they're certainly a force for the benefit of society in our world, make a difference for the world. I hope that we are, in some ways, that we are, I don't know if activist is the right word, but active in trying to improve the lives of all people everywhere, not just our own, that somehow we live for the benefit of others. The world's a better place because we were here. And I hope that as we go out and try to be beneficial in the world, the task of Buddhists or Buddhist practitioners is to try to figure out how to do it without harming anyone at all. And I like to think that somehow Buddhists are Buddhism, people who are Buddhist, try not to take sides too much, but try to find the midway or the third way or the way that what we all share. And I'd love it if Buddhism had a role as a mediator in conflicts rather than as people who take sides. But that's my thing. So I hope that some of you, all of you, I think all of you who are involved in some meditation, you came here and meditated today, that you will give some deeper thought and reflection to what the connection of meditation is to ethics. What's the connection between meditation and your behavior in the world? And what's the connection between meditation and living in such a way that your life is for the betterment of yourself and betterment of the world? And this is a very interesting topic. And you heard today many different responses. So there's not like one right answer, one right response. It's an interesting topic to also talk to other friends with. If you know other people who meditate or do something comparable, to explore it with them as well and discuss it with them. So thank you very much, and be well.